when we get to number one on iTunes for the technology how-to podcast, I'm getting that tattooed with like black letter type and like barbed wire going around iTunes logo and like a single tear.
Hello and welcome to The Dirt. I am Tim Wright and today I'm here with Steve Hickey.
Hello.
Hello, Steve. And I'm also here with Mark Grambo.
Hey, Tim. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Mark. How about yourself?
Charming.
Wonderful. That's weird. And I'm also here with extra special guest Chris Nostel. Chris is the design fellow at Cooper and co-author of Make It So and About Face. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome to me.
See, we're starting off well.
I love that, though. So we're doing a series on designing for the future. And we wanted to have Chris on the show because of his great work with Make It So and in his personal blog. And this one is a specific show about fictional UI design, the design that we haven't quite reached yet, or just designing in our mind and just very cool things. Right, Mark?
Do you need to be rescued
from
your own sentence?
I am just death staring right at you. I wish this was a video podcast. You could just see my laser eyes.
Yeah, we thought it would be fun to start this whole series off instead of, you know, what are we designing today for practical things to what Chris has built an expertise in, which is designing for fictional user interfaces in film and science fiction. And that line that has to be grappled in fictional UI of looking like someone could actually use that thing while also looking cool. Perhaps more so than we tie ourselves down to in day-to-day UI.
This is much more than a watch sort of a show.
What makes sci-fi such an interesting lens for studying interaction and UI design through, in your opinion?
In my opinion? No, this is objective fact.
Okay. All right. Perfect. Confidence.
So the thing that makes sci-fi such a great lens for studying interaction design and interface design is that it's fun. It is hard to sit through, like an episode of Star Trek or Star Wars, you know, knock on wood for December's reboot of the series, and not really genuinely get excited about what's happening on stage. What's happening on screen, right? Like, even besides the explosions, interface designers' eyes sort of get brighter when that interface shows up on screen. And we go, wow, that's really cool. I wonder if I could do my next app that cool. So one of the facts is just it's very exciting. And the second reason that's probably even more important is that it is a shared reference.
Okay.
Right? Like we do, certainly at Cooper, we do work with all sorts of clients. And then we rightfully shut up about those projects until they've launched. And a lot of like our enterprise work is nobody really sees unless they work for those clients. And a lot of our cool design work you don't see till about a year or two later, when it's implemented, depending on who's implementing it. But we have a shared reference. If I try and tell you about one of the 100 apps on my phone, you may not know what the hell I'm talking about. But if I talk to you about the light table in Oblivion, your brain can almost certainly go directly there. And then we can have a conversation that's fruitful and fun.
You, of course, have the one that's referenced the most in the last couple of years being Minority Report. It feels like, you know, every couple of months somebody's releasing something where it's like, oh, and it's going to be like Minority Report in this way or that way.
It is shocking how long lived that is.
Seriously.
Do you remember when Minority Report was released?
Please don't tell me it was over 10 years ago.
It was like the 80s.
No, it was like 2001 about.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to guess.
Not about. It was 2001.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
14 years later, we are still talking about that interface. And it's not like it was certainly narratively very engaging. Obviously, it was burned onto the brain of the psyche of everyone in the audience. But it wasn't a great real world interface.
Oh, no.
No. And so, it's shocking how big an impact that was. It's almost like from Star Wars, the Cantina Band scene. Like, you're kind of rolling around in this desert with obviously it feels like a Western the first time you're watching A New Hope. And then suddenly you're dropped into this scene with weird aliens and crazy music. Oh, my God, that guy has a laser stick and he's chopped out that guy. Like, that scene was so burned into our brains. And Minority Report did it with an interface. And that was pretty cool, but it's also been something of an albatross around interaction design's neck since.
Yeah, I think it was perhaps the first time we saw anything like that kind of interface. We saw a multi-touch interface, you know, and it had its weird anachronisms that, you know, Tom Cruise was wearing gloves in it. He had to wear special gloves in order to use this big floaty screen in front of him. But it actually wasn't that long between then and when we actually saw that interface come to be in 2007 with the introduction of iOS, well, the iPhone.
There it is.
But that's, well, there was.
There's
the
Mark's
first,
Apple intro
that was
to
the first,
show.
Well, that was the first mainstream use, the first less mainstream application. I see there was a researcher, I want to say out of MIT, God, I wish I remember this fellow's name, who was showing off large scale, large displays, good like 60-inch displays with multi-technology. But it was just 2007 where you finally saw it in a consumer application.
You're talking about, well, the original Minority Report interface was based on the work by John Underkoffler, but Jeff Hahn is the
Jeff
one.
Jeff Hahn, there we go.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
He presented it at TED and convinced people it was real, which was really weird because the Minority Report interface was real.
Yeah.
Oblong Industries has been selling it to CEOs who want to be Tom Cruise in their spare time for years now. But Jeff Hahn got the TED cred.
But to your point about the shared reference, the TED cred or being the first consumer device or being in a big science fiction, you know, blockbuster does mean something because it's the first time that there's a collective consciousness around it. And it's not just in our industry. It's not just in a research paper and it's not just in some enterprise technology.
Well, it's one of the reasons why the project is sort of meaningful to me, not just as an academic exercise, but sort of as a mission-driven thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the things that we see on screen affect us both as designers and consumers and affect our clients and our stakeholders. And everyone has this expectation of both, oh, that's what's coming, and B, that's going to be good because it's exciting and it's on this giant screen. And that's not always the case.
Yeah.
And literally, like I used to tell folks that my mission is to get people to stop watching sci-fi and to start using it. And even more so to be skeptical of it because it's cool. But if we were to try and implement like that, the Minority Report gesture, the gestural interface in reality, people would get exhausted within the first 10 minutes of using it. It was pretty interesting that you had talked about the iPad being the same interface, I mean, the iPhone being the same interface, because it's not. The Minority Report interface has your hands in the air and extended towards the content, whereas the iPhone requires your fingers on a screen. Turns out that we're much more precise when we have resistance to our gestures, and when we have a 2D surface to work with, and they're not the same things, but they feel the same.
Right.
And we need to be cautious about distinguishing between one and the other.
We had done some work here for a client looking into 3D gestural interfaces using depth sensing cameras, and when they were first coming to us, when we were first starting the project, it was very tempting to think that the interface was like the next step of multi-touch, you know, where you're waving your hand in front of a laptop or a camera or something, and something on screen was occurring because it was mapping your hand in 3D space. And as we started to work at it, we realized very quickly that it was much closer to a mouse interface, and it was indirect.
Yeah.
You know, multi-touch was great because you get the sense of touching the content itself, while with a mouse,
There's this space between what you're doing,
right,
that sort of just,
well, you're moving
makes
one
everything
thing
lower fidelity.
You're moving one thing to move another. It's like moving a little model car on the desk in front of you and then watching a virtual car in the screen move around versus actually reaching into the screen and holding the digital car moving around. So multi-touch was that much more natural. You're directly interacting, and we stop and we think that just by floating our arms around, it's somehow more natural, but without without any sense of contact, it's really not there, which is why I'm at least more optimistic about something like the next big thing that I hear people comment about all the time in interface design that's a little more recent than Minority Report is Iron Man.
Yeah,
and all
that's
of the
one I bring up all
and
the
all
time.
The Tony Stark interfaces that have come in these movies since, because at least there, yeah, he's floating his hand around, but at least there's projected 3D light there, and it looks like he's working with a holograph or a hologram.
Fuzzy airspace.
Or volumetric projection, whatever.
There you go.
that's a better word.
It's the academic precise word. It's not as pretty though.
But yeah, we see these like Leap Motion as an example of, I saw a video of Elon Musk manipulating a 3D object. It was in the screen, but he was, you know, working with his hands to move it around with a Leap Motion. And that's like a little bit of that that Iron Man-y interface that we're seeing. And Chris, I'm wondering if you see the science fiction elements leaking into real world product design or vice versa at all?
Yes. There are lots of idiosyncratic one-off stories because, of course, science fiction isn't a monolith. Design isn't a monolith. These are people inside of these domains that are working to make good things happen. And they get inspired by things that they see in the world around them. And whether that comes on a screen or at a shopping mall or on a phone in their hands, inspiration can come from anywhere. At a systemic level, there are a number of different ways that they influence one another. The real world ends up influencing science fiction by being the model from which it extends. Sci-fi, especially like blockbusters, have to be really careful about how much narrative time they spend explaining to the audience what the technology can do or what the characters are doing. Mm-hmm. And you don't have a lot of that time. You know, nobody wants to sit through a 30-minute prologue to understand, is the guy going to get the girl? So the little notes, the hints about what is different in the world that you're seeing have to be fairly quick. And blockbusters have even more pressure than, say, literary sci-fi. And what that means is that sci-fi tends to extend our existing reality just out a little bit. I like to say the pattern is what you know plus one. Mm-hmm. And that's the way a lot of blockbusters work. And so we in the real world, those of us who are designing the real world, are actually establishing that base of operations from which sci-fi picks an axis to extend. Now, what's interesting is that sci-fi itself can add to that model of reality that then gets extended. Certainly, once the Minority Report interface was burned into people's minds, you could take a shortcut in a later piece of sci-fi that looked kind of Minority Report-ish, and people would be like, oh, I know what that is. Hmm. So it's not purely reality that sci-fi references, but it is certainly what the audience is building on, and sci-fi has to respect that. The other direction, sci-fi does end up influencing reality in a number of ways. One, of course, it sets our expectations for what is good and what is coming. Mm-hmm. And in fact, like the Nathan Shedroff, my co-author on the book part of the project, first came up with the idea for the book when the Motorola StarTAC phone had come out. Because it opened exactly like a communicator. Mm-hmm. And of course, with the name StarTAC, they're not really veiling the fact that it's a reference at all.
They knew exactly what they did with that.
They knew exactly what they did with that. They were camping on this excitement that had been built up on in their audiences for the past 30 years. Mm. And so setting that expectation and even building on that built expectation and even built training is one of the ways that sci-fi sort of influences us and influences markets. There are two other ways. One is by reminding us of the constraints that we're working under. A lot of stories in sci-fi scenes in sci-fi will tell stories about people trying to use technologies and then the technologies not being right or forgetting that they're working with a human. Mm-hmm. And so that ends up reminding us a lot. And then the last way is by actually proposing new paradigms, like the Minority Report pre-crime scrubber. That's mm-hmm. like a brand new paradigm, or volumetric projections. We see them all over sci-fi. They're not in the real world yet, but we have kind of know what to expect because Hollywood and, of course, television for a while has been like thinking about them in a smoke and mirrors kind of way. Mm-hmm.
I feel like if you look at the pre-CGI interface work, you actually, instead of having the whole like, oh, this needs to look cool so people look at it and go, wow, you instead actually have the technology aiding the drama of the story. So like if you look at the Nostromo's computer from Alien, for example,
yep.
that starts off the whole, what are you laughing
at? Nothing. Go ahead.
We're having a show
he
about.
He speaks my language.
We're having a show about user interfaces in science fiction. We're going to talk about science fiction.
I haven't seen Alien.
Oh my God.
Whatever.
Just go watch it right now. We'll be waiting here for you when you're done. Anyways, if you look at the computer from the Nostromo on Alien, it's a shitty old CRT monitor, as the technology of the time suggests, because without CGI to rely on, it was harder to go beyond that. But the computer actually begins telling the story by just giving you these cues about what's going to happen and just leaking these little details from the corporation in. Or if you look at the first example I really remember from when I was little, was the targeting computer in X-Wings, in the first Star Wars movie during the trench run.
Miserable interface, yeah.
Yeah, terrible interface, but yeah. It adds a ton of drama because you can see this thing swirling around the edges of that circle, and you know the drama happens. If it locks in the middle, then all of a sudden that person is dead. And so you're sitting there on the edge of your seat like, staring at a bunch of shitty little crystals that are shining light at you going, oh my God, don't go in the middle. Like, I find that to be really interesting. Like, it creates drama, and then you come up through this new stuff where we have CGI, we can do whatever we want, we can do whatever we can imagine, and it just instead turns into, look how cool this shit is, instead of, where's the drama, I guess?
Right. Well, what's interesting about the X-Wing example is that it didn't replace the drama of the quote-unquote real thing.
Yeah.
There was still a diegetic camera aimed at the exhaust port, mm-hmm. And it was an additional confirmation mm-hmm. of, oh my God, is he going to hit it? Is he going to hit it? And you're right. Like, that scene could have played just fine without the interface, mm-hmm. But it told us a number of things. It certainly helped reinforce that this was happening in the future, even though technically it happened a long, long time ago. But it certainly adds something to it, right? It gives the camera something else to jump to and mm-hmm. a second source of information that we just inherently trust. We're like, well, our eyes might tell us one thing, or that diegetic camera might tell us another thing. I'm certain that computer screen is going to tell me exactly what it sees and whether or not it's worked or not. Mm-hmm. Sci-fi is certainly like latched onto interfaces, and largely post-Star Trek, as a way to help tell their stories, to visualize things that are really hard to show on camera. Mm-hmm. But I think in the best of cases, in order to amplify the drama that is on screen by adding to another channel that we're having to monitor or even just sit with as they're going.
The more it becomes a narrative element, the more emphasis they put into it, the more art they try and get into it to try and let it tell the story more, which means more often than not, it's more open to ridicule too for looking completely ridiculous. You know, the more you have to show the interface, the more I'm like, how would anyone use that computer? Because of course they're using it almost purely as a narrative device, when at least when it's done poorly. And I sit there thinking, this is insane. That is an unusable thing. You know, or why are it? Or look at another kind of interface, physical interface, in the semi-recent reboot of Battlestar Galactica, how every single sheet of paper has its corners cut off to be octagonal.
That drove me nuts.
Which was just meant to be like a thing to make it look cool. But I'm sitting there, and my wife, who is a paper artist, we're sitting there going, that's so much more labor for everyone in that universe who has to make paper. That's so inefficient. It makes no sense. And I think any movie that you see, any piece of fiction, you bring your expertise into. I'm sure that there are lawyers watching legal dramas going, oh my God, no courtroom is like that. I remember my father, who's a psychiatrist, watching A Beautiful Mind going, that's not at all how schizophrenia works.
So yeah. Battlestar Galactica was actually interesting because I feel like it went back to that sort of pre-CGI drama yeah. of an interface where they deliberately created a universe where the technology in a specific area wasn't as sophisticated as we would normally imagine it, because these people had suffered due to the effects of networking computers. Mm-hmm. And so they just removed that from their entire history. They have spacecraft. They travel from planet to planet, but nothing is networked because they're so terrified of what happens when two computers touch each other. So then you actually have things like the Dreadus interface inside of the Vipers are like, they build drama by showing things that you can't see yet coming towards you, and you're trying to figure out what's going to be exposed when the camera can finally look forward and see what you are just getting from a little electronic blip.
Yeah. I think they did a wonderful job in everything but the cornered paper, which, yeah. again, looks cool.
But it's so weird.
Well, and looks different is probably yeah. more to the point. I've heard legend that where that came from was from the original Battlestar Galactica television show. The director had given the art director the instruction to cut corners on the budget. So as a joke, he cut the corners of all the paper on the set, and the director came back and said, I love it.
Oh, God, that's one of those things where you think you're really going to piss somebody off, and then they get one over on you by actually liking it.
And they commit to it.
Well, and the best part about that is the beautiful irony of it is it was a commentary on not wanting to cut corners, so they cut corners. The person then said, yes, go do that, but now you can't cut corners because it adds tremendous amount of labor to everything. Beautiful linguistic irony there.
This has been the most impassioned segment in the history of this podcast.
I care about my science fiction, Tim.
We've had how many shows about accessibility?
Hundreds, it feels like.
Well, and if I could toot the project's horn a little bit, this is true. I talk about this topic a lot around the world at conferences. And people really, they are passionate about it. And we could talk about the sort of theories of why. But I think that if people are sort of impassioned in a particular way about these stories, then it's a really natural place to begin to focus and say, well, what stake do I have in this? Mm-hmm. And certainly all the interaction designers have that same moment of, well, that would never really work that way. Or industrial designers looking at the lightsaber and saying, what do you mean there's no guard? That would be disastrous. All those little 2-year-olds at Jedi Academy would just end up headless in the first 5 minutes.
Oh, God.
Or armless. Yeah, it's terrifying.
Ugh.
Well, like, they have robot arms for that.
That's true.
So,
that's true.
You know, they'd be fine.
So here's a particularly useless piece of interaction.
Well, yeah, let's add it to the show then.
Yeah, of course. No, so... You want to talk about accessibility. This is incredibly inaccessible. The control console in the TARDIS from Doctor Who, where it adds to the drama of the episode. It's entirely mechanical, and he just runs around this round thing in the middle of the spacecraft, creating drama as everything breaks down around him, and he's madly tossing levers and things like that. Can you imagine any person with a physical disability attempting to use that interface? And the entire species, they're called Time Lords, so that's basically the like height of aristocracy. You can only use this if you are as perfect as the rest of us. There's no accessibility consideration there whatsoever.
Awful.
Well, actually, We know that accessibility is always a trade-off for security, and it might just be that exact same thing. I am loathe to point to episodes 1 through 3 of Star Wars because they're terrible movies, but let me do that very briefly for a counterexample or... maybe a similar example. There is a Sith Lord whom I cannot remember, but who is pretty much mostly robot with a few organs left in. You guys remember his name?
Oh, yeah.
General Grievous, but he's not a Sith Lord.
Right. But he's like a robot with 4 lightsabers.
He actually just takes lightsabers from Jedi he kills, but he has no force powers. Tim Starp looking at me like
what
that.
What a jerk. there's a really fascinating part. He's got a monocycle vehicle that he rides around in the course of that movie. And you get a very close shot of the interface that he has for it. It's a tiny purple circle that sits on the armrest of his monocycle. Mm. And if you look closely and you pause it and screen cap it, like I do, you'll see that the buttons are impossibly tiny.
Yeah.
And that no human could use it.
But he has his claws and he's tapping away very precisely at it.
Right. So it's both the combination of the precision and the gross violation of Fitt's law that means that nobody else but General Grievous is going to be able to use this cycle. Hmm. And at first, like when I was writing that thing up for the book, the interface for the book, I was like, this is terrible. Here are all the reasons. And then you have to take that tack of apologetics and say, wait a minute, but why is this right for the diegesis, to throw another $20 word on the conversation. It's actually perfect. No Jedi could sit down in that machine and actually operate it. It really makes it custom for him. And that makes me wonder if the TARDIS interface is similar. It's actually prevention from anyone else, but Time Lords from using it.
Well, so there's a joke at one point in the show where it says it's actually designed to be piloted by 6 people simultaneously, which is why the just single pilot is so ludicrous.
Right.
But it just adds to like the zany madcap weirdness of the show, I think, more than anything else.
I think it also presents, I could also look at this as actually a fairly optimistic view of the future, a future in which we aren't all asked to use a fairly homogenous interface. You know, right now we have a default interface of that keyboard, which is almost the identical layout for most people, fairly identical mechanics, a mouse, maybe a trackpad. And if you have a visual or cognitive or hearing disability of any kind, you have to use some other sort of device that's really expensive. And there's a whole lot of learning to go around that. When, in fact, in the future, if every single thing was like General Grievous's crazy, you know, thing that works perfectly for him. If our computers can get far
just
enough,
completely customized to
truly adapt to the individual, where technology becomes personal enough that of course you can't use anyone else's things, but why would you? Because all of your things work perfectly for you. And if you picked up somebody else's crazy bicycle or computer or communicator or whatever it was, it would see you, understand you, and adapt to you immediately. So I think science fiction can provide a bit of a model for maybe an optimistic view of the future in that regard.
As opposed to a desolate post-apocalyptic wasteland.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a positive spin. That's the Grambo spin on things.
I'm just an optimistic guy.
Yeah.
I did want to mention actually one other example that not a lot of certainly Americans know about, but if you're really interested in a semi-absurdist pre-CGI space television show, there is a delightful German program from 1966, and I would not dare to murder the German itself. The English translation of the television show is Space Patrol Orion.
Oh, geez.
And it predates Star Trek. It's 1966. It's black and white. And their budget was so ridiculously low that you will see things like faucets attached vertically in the interface, and the poor actors are like committing to turning the hot knob and then having a very serious look on their face. Like, yes, this is a thing. I'm doing space things now.
Oh my God.
And they have like plastic cups attached to the ceiling for lights. And they even have, I think I remember seeing an electric iron like mashed into an interface once. And oh, if you're really interested in that sort of the what I would consider the campiest non-CGI interface in sci-fi, it's definitely Star Patrol Orion. And I think you can get the DVD out now. So definitely check it out if that's your thing.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to have to look that up.
So we've talked about a lot of bad interfaces so far in fictional UI design. Chris, I'd like to know if you've seen anything that's just an amazing fictional UI interface that you really want to have in real life, a like nonfiction interface. Right. Someone just nailed it dead on.
You're hearing a brief hesitation only because, A, there are a lot of caveats to that answer. But B, I spoke at the inaugural Boing Boing convention called Ingenuity, where I actually gave a talk on the best and worst interfaces in sci-fi. So I don't want to replicate the examples that I gave there. What I'll do is instead I'll just talk about 2014, because there was a lot of stuff at 2014 that I thought was actually really good and really good in subtle ways. Let's see. Who here, raise your hand, since I can see you on video, even though your podcast audience cannot, saw Captain America the Winter Soldier?
Oh, of course.
All of us are raising our hands.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, there's a scene there where Nick Fury is in a car, an SUV, that he's just driving along, talking, using a heads-up display, having a telephone conversation when he has to slam on the brakes because of a car in front of him, and then suddenly he's surrounded by people in police uniforms that are clearly not police, and then he begins to get attacked in a very systematic way. They pull out the machine guns and begin to fire at the vehicle. There's even this giant sort of sledgehammer machine that bangs the door trying to crack the window down. But what's really fascinating about this interface is not that it is just providing some readouts for him, like, oh, hey, here's how much damage your car has taken. Here is how much structural integrity the window has. And oh my God, we really have to do something. But if you pay attention to the order of operations, it actually does some things on his behalf that he does not ask it to do. So at one point, like, he's looking around and trying to get out of the way of the window that he's been shot through. And the heads up agent talks to him and says, there are no police reported in this area. Nick Fury didn't ask that question. Yeah. But it is a very obvious question to ask and is pretty important to our understanding of what's going on. No, he's not being attacked by, our friends in blue. This is somebody else using that as a cover. There are several other things that occur over the course of the scene that let you know that this isn't just a responsive interface. It's a forward-looking interface that is actually thinking about Nick's goals, thinking about his situation, and doing things on its own accord to help him get safe to safety and out of the jam that he's in. So for my money, both the visual design, the motion design, and the subtle way that this worked in the scene, and like it happened so quickly and so dramatically that a lot of the audience didn't register how new that was. Nobody in the real world is using an interface quite like that, I guess, unless you're Tony Stark. And so that ranks really high up there amongst one of my favorites from the prior year. And it actually ties into a similarly subtle scene from Guardians of the Galaxy. Very early in the film, we head to the planet. Oh my goodness, my sci-fi nerd brain is not coming up with the name of the planet. Anyone?
We'll call it Planet Pants, just Earth. For fun.
All right. Rocky is there in a big square, and he's looking for marks. He's kind of a bounty hunter. Mm. And he's got this tablet that is transparent that he holds up. And when he holds it up in front of someone's face, it gives them a little readout on that person and whether they have any warrants out for their arrest that he could take advantage of and make some money off of. And he goes around, he takes a look at a kid, makes sort of a funny remark about the kid, letting you know sort of what a acerbic personality Rocket has. And then he passes over this other character and he calls him sort of a perv. And of course that is
Stan Lee
yeah. from the Marvel Universe. That's where his cameo comes in. And then interestingly, Rocket puts the interface down and he has a conversation with Groot because Groot is drinking out of a fountain. But it is while the interface is down that he hears a double beep. And that double beep lets him know, hey, you need to pick this interface up again. And as soon as he does, it lets him know, hey, there's a very high value mark in the area that you might want to check out. Huh. And that, of course, leads him to the main protagonist. So if this interface could do that searching for him, why on earth did he bother picking it up and putting it at the people around him? That's a pretty sophisticated little pattern. He could have just been taking a coffee yeah. and waited till the beep happened. And then gone, oh, hey, my toast is done. Now I can check up and move along with the story. But it, of course, we understand from an audience extra diegetic point of view that this is just letting us into Rocket's character. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, from a diegetic perspective, Rocket's character is still there in the world of the story, and he wants to play. Whether or not an agent is active and doing its thing and helping him achieve his goals, we still want to try to either beat it or keep our skills sharp, take into account something that the algorithm isn't taking into account. And that model, that pattern of let me play anyway, is really subtle, really bypasses you in the scene, and is my other massively favorite interface from 2014. So if I could have an agent that would both achieve my goals and let me play and be, still not a subservient person user, but a really active agent in that same system, then yeah, I'd be super impressed.
So basically Marvel's killing it.
Yeah, those two examples. I mean, there are plenty of examples. I haven't done a lot of reviews from the movies from 2014, kind of like the canonization of the saint. I like to let movies bake a little bit before I decide to review them. I want to give it time so that I'm just not building up the excitement. But yeah, Marvel has a lot of great talent that it is working with right now.
Good. We have another one coming out. When's the Ultron?
Coming out. A week from today.
Yes.
1 week.
Yeah, totally. A week from today.
Oh my God. So excited.
It's coming. I've got tickets.
It's in the future?
Yes. Good job, Tim.
Thank you.
Did it.
Thank you.
If anyone is listening to this show on the day that it comes out, it is not coming out a week from today. It's coming out in like 3 days. So if you missed opening weekend, don't blame us.
Mark is extremely concerned about that.
You know, a smart podcast playback would automatically be able to listen to the date and correct it for the listener's actual date or tell them that it was in the past.
We just found our new million-dollar app idea, a podcast app that listens to podcasts using audio and language analysis, naturally replaces all instances of time. And it does it in the person's voice using voice reconstruction.
I won't build it until Marvel comes out with that version.
Somebody from Marvel will listen to this podcast and it'll appear in the next movie. And then we will have completed the cycle.
There we go. That's it right there.
Well, Chris, we don't want to take up your entire afternoon, but I know you have some speaking engagements coming up that you wanted to run through if anyone wants to come hear you.
Oh, yeah, totally. There are two that I'd love to shill out. Actually, three. I'm speaking at UX London in about a month. So if any of your listeners are over the pond in London, you can come, and I'm doing a workshop called Redesigning Star Wars there, where we take a look at the original movie. We get into teams. I get those teams to analyze those interfaces and then literally just say, well, that's crap. Let's redesign it. It's a lot of fun. I did the first one in Stockholm last year and immediately got interest from folks around the world. I'm going to be redoing that same workshop sponsored by Autodesk in San Francisco in September. So the Redesigning Star Wars in September will be here in my hometown. And then I'll be heading back over the seas to Brighton, where I believe I'm going to be talking about the design of evil in sci-fi, which should be a super fun one as well.
Yeah.
These are so cool.
I have to conspire to be sent to Brighton, though.
There's a Brighton, like...
Not that one.
Oh, we have a Brighton, like, town over from us.
I don't know if...
It's
yeah.
not interesting.
It's a lesser Brighton.
Yeah.
It's a new Brighton.
Chris, thanks so much for taking time out of your day to come chat with us.
Sure, it was a lot of fun.
So if people want to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do that?
Fine question. One way to engage me sort of on sci-fi stuff, there's the blog at sci-fiinterfaces.com, where I not only like beg people to help me because holy cow, it's a lot of work. Also like if people have requests, I take requests for, hey, I really want to see you analyze this particular movie. That's how I end up doing Her from Spike Jones. But also commenting on the movies themselves, the analysis that we do. Certainly the blog is one place, sci-fiinterfaces.com, but the best place is I do a tweet from my name, Chris Nossel, super easy to find, and Sci-Fi Interfaces.
Great. And if anyone hasn't picked up Make It So, definitely definitely go and check that out. It's another Rosenfeld Media, another great one from Rosenfeld Media.
Yeah, and you can buy it from Amazon, but if you buy it from Lou, the Rosenfeld Media site, you get the physical book and the digital book at the same time. So I would recommend heading there.
We are truly living in the future.
I know. Future.
Well, you can get us on Twitter at The Dirt Show, and please send your long-winded comments to thedirt@freshtilledsoil.com. Please send us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you're listening to us now on. It helps us quite a bit to reach a larger audience and get great guests like Chris here because it gives us some street cred.
Yeah.
There we go.
So that's all we have for today. Thank you for listening, and we will try and do better next time.
It's a rare condition in this day and age to read any good news on the newspaper page.
Who was after that? Step by Step? It was Full House at 8, Family Matters 8:30, Step by Step at 9. I don't remember the 9:30 show.
I don't know. I mean, these times changed over.
Where was Boy Meets World?
That was a different era.
You sure?
Yeah. Please.
Which one was Step by Step? It was the...
The divorced family, or the restitched together family. They all had, like, weird neighbor friends, all those shows. They had Eddie Munster was on the Step by Step. He was the weird neighbor.
I don't think I've ever seen the Munsters.
There must be some magic glue inside these gentle walls.
Oh, good Lord.
All I see
it's
is
too
the
late
power
in the day
of
for
dreams.
This.
Real love bursting out of every scene.
I'm going to fucking murder you.
Days go by. It's the bigger love of the family.